When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown.
Thanks for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, a weekly 30 plus or minus minute show that occupies a collaborative space shared by Charleston's advocacy organizations, including Low Country Local First, the Coastal Conservation League, Charleston Moves, and If You Were Mayor. Today's segment is hosted by ifyouweremayor.com, a website that is about how we can individually and collectively engage to enhance the quality of life in Charleston. And we've invited architect Ray Huff to join us today due to his specific involvement in some of the big picture thinking that has been going on in Charleston over the course of the past few years. Obviously before that too, but we're going to be talking about more recent things. And so hello Ray, and welcome to Small Talks.
Thank you. Good morning.
Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, but since I know you're very keen on kind of working behind the scenes in the background, so I'm looking at this as an opportunity to share maybe some of the things you in some fashion have been part of over the past couple of years or so, and that are coming to light, namely the Low Line and the Medical District Project. I think that's the name. Is that kind of the name that it's going by?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, Ray, I've known you for 30 years.
I did the math, and you're right. I was astounded.
I know. And as an architect here, and as well as one of the founding faculty for the Clemson Architecture Center in Charleston, and that was early on, just part-time, and in the intervening years, your role has certainly grown and become far more significant. And you're now the director of that center and one of the primary teaching faculty. You want to just briefly give us a little overview on that and about how the students sort of benefit from that?
Sure.
Because they come here, I used to call it the Clemson Students Year Abroad.
That's right, sort of in country. Well, the program, the Clemson Architectural Center, was started in 1987. And I will say that Whitney Powers was one of our very first faculty and resident at the center back in 1989.
Oh, those were the
90,
days.
And that's when Whitney and I first met. And it's been an extraordinary friendship and collaboration over those years. But the Clemson Architecture Center is one of three off-campus programs that Clemson School of Architecture has. One, which is 40 years old, is in Genoa, Italy. And that was founded to give students an opportunity to live and travel in Europe, to get a sense of places other than South Carolina, since most of our students at the time were really South Carolinians. And then when the former, now former president, Jim Barker, came on as dean of the School of Architecture, he decided that we needed a presence in Charleston. What better urban laboratory for students to study than Charleston? So he asked that I help shape that program and put it together, and I did that for a number of years, and it was a great deal of fun. And in 2001, I think it is, we opened a center in Barcelona. So students have the opportunity to work and study in three different locales, and we're even now looking at other places, perhaps a bit more further abroad, where things are happening globally, which has been a conversation we're having in the school. The CACC specifically is based in Charleston, and we're happy to say that we're moving into the cigar factory on the second floor. We'll have virtually that entire second floor and some of the first. That will give us an opportunity to really broaden our programming, which we've been limited by size. That will include the Clemson Architectural Center. It will include the master's program, Masters of Science in Historic Preservation. It will include a new program that we're creating, a resilient urban design. It's a graduate program. an architecture and health studio, and we'll hopefully have a flex studio so other programs from other locations and schools could come in and use the facility. But just as importantly, it gives us a room that we can seat 100 people or more. And that's critical to our programming because that allows us to do certain outreach programming that we hadn't been able to do before. Our focus at the CACC has always been to kind of blur the lines between the academy and practice. And we do that by focusing almost entirely on community service projects. So the students are working in a community with a client on a project that has legitimate potential for being realized. And that's a market distinction that we're seeing now in architectural education. Is it just simply a hypothetical problem that you invent and the student designs it, which is still a good exercise? But this raises the ante a little bit because it means the students have to be responsive to people who have legitimate needs, and sometimes the needs are critically important needs, and other times it's simply to help people sort of realize possibilities. We're doing work with Metanoa at Cherokee Neighborhood in North Charleston now. They help repurpose the old Chicora Graded School, it was
right.
called.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had a series of public meetings, community meetings there, and that's the kind of thing that we're focusing on.
That Metanoia has really been a great force in that neighborhood.
Terrific force. And Bill Stanfield is just a remarkable person. I'm learning so much from him.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for that insight. And maybe we're going to turn our attention to some of these urban projects that that the center has perhaps been involved with, but more specifically that you have and or have some memory mm-hmm. or some longer-term connection to, and particularly some of those that maybe have been initiated under the aegis of Joe Riley, mm-hmm. But will gestate and possibly, hopefully, mm-hmm. be realized in the future. Mm-hmm. The first that I would like to discuss then is the Lowcountry Lowline.
Right.
And which is a park that is proposed to occur in the railroad right-of-way that runs from the vicinity, let's say, of John Street or Mary Street.
Actually,
north to...
it's Wolf, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, something that I guess it goes right through kind of the visitor center in some respects.
Well, eventually.
Technically.
Yeah, eventually.
And that runs north to this area up around
yeah.
Mount Pleasant
mm-hmm.
Street.
North of where we are now at Joseph Lloyd Manor.
And I understand that this is seen as somewhat inspired by New York City's High Line, mm-hmm. the park constructed on a section of abandoned raised railroad trestle, which it's had an amazing economic impact on the western edge of Manhattan. But I also think it's important for our listeners to recognize that that much-touted High Line was really driven by a grassroots effort.
That's right. That's
no
right.
one, with the exception of a couple of guys, Joshua That's David it. And Robert Hammond,
yeah.
Could even foresee any semblance of the kind of transformation that has occurred there.
Right.
And could you give us maybe an overview of the Lowcountry Lowline and how it started? Because I think there's a little bit of a grassroots
sure.
sort of thinking there, too.
Yeah. Well, really, I would attribute the inspiration of this to Mike Mesner. Mike, who has a foundation that is devoted to creating public space, open green space in cities, in urban areas in particular, really was the person that came in and says, we need to do this. And he connected with Tom Bradford. And if you want to get anything done in this town, you call Tom.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
Has a way of doing it. He's remarkable. And it's certainly, in many ways, it was Mike and his Speedwell Foundation
right.
and Tom Bradford that have been the impetus for this to really kind of drive this. And they put together a board. I was fortunate enough to be asked to be part of that board. And the low line, which is about a 1.6, I think it is, a mile stretch of railroad right-of-way that runs just north of us, really down into the heart of Charleston, and it splits Meeting and King Street. And many people don't know this, but King Street used to be, of course, simply an animal trail. And then the Native Americans used that trail for obvious reasons. The animals, and certainly the Native Americans, were smart enough to know if you didn't walk in the trail, yeah, you're walking the marsh and the bog, so you use the trail. And then the settlers, the colonists came in. And that became, at some point, the King's Highway. So it's King Street as we know it. But that's the backbone of the peninsula. Everything sheds from that King Meeting spline that runs through the city. And the railroad has been, that line has been there for a number of years now. So the idea was to take this really fundamentally underutilized property and try to bring it back into the public realm so it can be accessed and used safely by citizens of the community. And that effort, I guess three plus years ago, seemed like a daunting task. It still is, but at least the acquisition of the land is within grasp.
Right. Right.
And it's going to be a remarkable thing, because what it's going to do, it's going to be one of the connectors that begins to re-knit and tie together the peninsula in many ways. Some people are fearful that it will be something that will be really used by tourists and what have you. I don't think that's going to be necessarily the case. I think what will happen is that as it comes into the urban core, down around Post Courier and then south of that, that's where a lot of sort of urban development, and that is really the place of congregation, as it were. But as you move north, I think it's really going to be used as a much more of a passive point of biking and walking and that sort of thing. The issue that one has in anything like this is that it opens up a part of the city that heretofore had been closed. As all of us know, the extent of development in the city is extraordinary, and it's all moving north. I tell everybody, buy in North Charleston. That's the where you need to be, because as we see, property values are escalating dramatically. And there's a lot of pressure on the Upper Peninsula, Wagner Terrace, and other West Side neighborhoods to retain some of that really traditional population. I grew up on Ashley Avenue near Hugie, between Hugie and Moutrie. In fact, I hope to build a house on some property I have in Parkwood. So I have a lot of connection with that neighborhood. And I've seen that neighborhood transition now. This is the third transition. As a seventh grader delivering prescriptions for Hampton Pharmacy up in Wagner Terrace, it was all white, primarily Jewish. Then it became essentially all African American. Now it's transitioning into, we will wait to see what that's going to be. Well, that puts a lot of pressure on people who have homes there and have lived there for a number of years. And as a consequence of this kind of thing is a fair gentrification, which will come. So the challenge becomes, how do you begin to thwart that in some way so that people can have a sense of belonging and not feel pressured to leave? And I think the key to that is engagement of the community and the realization of the low line, what this thing actually becomes. And that's a process we're starting in earnest now with community meetings and what have you. We think it's essential that folks who live in that community have a invested interest, and I mean more than simply being interested, but actually a financial connection to this in some fashion. If it's going to be, if it's happening, then people have to feel like there is some gain beyond a recreational opportunity. And so I would hope that there could be some economic opportunities for people who live there, create small businesses. We don't know exactly how that might realize. The larger benefit for the community, of course, for the city, is that it would be starting to connect on a pedestrian cycling way down to an extension to the Cooper River, going through the Lee Street corridor, tying back through Hampton Park, and then moving back through the west side of the peninsula and into the medical district, which you talked about a moment ago, tying into Long Lake, Colonial Lake, and eventually the Battery. Suddenly you have this network of interconnected pathways that we sort of used to have, but we kind of lost. You know, the interior of one thing, it was a lot easier to move around the city when I was a kid. Right. And there were a lot of interior lanes that no longer exist. Were simply abandoned properties or open properties. That's all been developed. So this provides an opportunity to move around this city in a way heretofore that we really haven't had, except on the street itself, because Charleston is an extraordinary pedestrian city, one of the most pedestrian in America.
Well, I think it's interesting. I saw something yesterday that was talking about this, which is not likely to pass, but the Obama, President Obama's budget proposal and its transportation facet really had a focus on how do you develop projects of sorts that might actually heal some of the some of the sort of schisms that some of the past road construction did. And we certainly see that with I-26, and we see that with Highway 17 and the even Highway 61, and mm-hmm. some of the way that, that these past road constructions have essentially
right.
sort of severed neighborhoods. And I think that that goal within the low line is a good one. I do think it's a challenge. I know I serve on the board of the South Carolina Community Loan Fund, and mm-hmm. we've mm-hmm. been really kind of looking into what kinds of things can be done to actually preserve affordable housing and encourage affordable housing in the future. And there have been some pretty there are some pretty creative things that have been done in other places, and so you know hopefully that
and
that
you're
will
responsible
find its way here.
Some of that you did these extraordinary affordable homes on Coronelet Street a number of years ago.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that was that was almost 30 years ago. So in a way, some of this sort of has the one side of this, as far as probably the development community is concerned, mm-hmm. is this kind of Bilbao effect.
Right.
You know, that you
right.
have this cultural museum or institution
yeah.
that's designed for yeah. somewhat abandoned and neglected area, probably inhabited by the immigrants or the
mm-hmm.
poor,
mm-hmm.
and the result is the world comes knocking. And so in I think you've touched on some of the concepts that
yeah.
that are hopeful, and as far as your mm-hmm. role in this, as far as preserving the local quality of life. I mean, I think many of the locals would like to see that this is not just another tourist amenity,
right,
and I think that that's going to be important. And so I certainly appreciate it. It does seem like this is an important piece. There's a lot of discussion about
mm-hmm.
several important pieces that are sort of floating
mm-hmm.
around. I think we have the Legree Bridge bicycling
right.
connection, which is another
sure.
conversation, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
we could go down that road. but I do think you mentioned Chicora. I mean, I think
right.
connecting
sure.
you know, some ways to connect all the way up there is very important. I know that in fact this is a very areas where there's been discussion about bus rapid transit, for
exactly.
instance.
Exactly right.
Some of the alternative transportation or mass
right.
transit opportunities
mm-hmm.
that exist really in parallel to 26 rather than
right.
or as an alternative to
right.
getting on 26 and obviously something that needs to happen.
Right.
So is there any way that that our listeners can get involved or keep up with the progress of this project?
And, sure. Let's start a campaign to de-elevate I-26 as it comes to the city. There's no reason for it to do that.
Well, that would be a good
one. The citizens did a study a few years ago where we looked at that and pretty exhaustively determined that you can really create the same traffic flow in the city with a series of boulevards if you were to essentially de-ramp it and drop it down the grade level, make it a boulevard, use Meeting and East Bay as companion boulevards, so you're spreading your traffic a bit. It could work. There's no reason for that thing to exist. It's already reached the end of its service life. They will extend it, of course, because they can't afford to do anything else. So that's one thing we can do. That'd be a great project, I think. You talk about remaking a city. I think the biggest challenge for me as an architect and as a African-American is I see development in a positive way. I see it's a positive way of energizing a city, making a place vital. In a perfect world, it means that people who perhaps have not had access to the resources of a city and the energy of the city can come back into the city. But the reality of the world today is that as the cities in America revitalize, they become out of reach financially.
Right.
So there has to be some mechanism for addressing that, and that has to be done with the same energy that we look at other concerns about traffic and transportation, environmental issues. Affordability has got to be at the very top of the perspective. Otherwise,
well, and there are things that are woven together that you can't, they're inextricably linked.
Exactly,
And we need to keep some perspective
that's right.
on that. And I'm glad that someone like you is
yeah.
Is
yeah.
sort of a participant in that discussion. And certainly we want to keep as many people involved or engaged
right.
in that discussion as possible. Because
I think it's critical because what we're seeing in the peninsula, you know, the adage is that 120 years ago, there were more than twice the number of people living on the peninsula that there is now. The difference is we've got, 3-5 million tourists a year. So that the visitors have increased. But secondly, we've congested the city with cars, and also we live bigger. You know, 125 years ago, it may have been five families living in a tenement on Legree Street. Well, that's not the case anymore. There may be a family living in a 4,000 square foot house, whatever. So it's changed the dynamic. And what we're seeing is it be essentially the dispossession of African Americans on the peninsula. And unfortunately, that's not a good thing. If we lose that kind of diversity, ethnic and cultural diversity, I think the city will be the poorer for it. Now we're seeing young people and creative people come into the city, and that's a good thing. So how do we begin to change that pattern is a real challenge. None of these issues are easy. You know, affordability, for example, that's laissez-faire economics. I mean, it's hard to buck that. You can't build any cheaper, fundamentally, I mean, to a certain point. But there has to be layered over that other really creative strategies about how the city takes a much more proactive role. When the developer comes into the city, I'm going to build X on a market rate, fine. But you're going to have to provide something else. You've got to give something back for that profit. And until we can get to that point more in earnest than we have, there are a lot of things about Andres Duany that I don't agree with. But there are actually a lot of things I do agree with. And one of the things Andres said was that we're not out begging for people to come in and develop. People are begging us. So we kind of hold the cards.
Well, I mean, Charles Chase said that years ago.
That's true.
And
he did.
And I remember explicitly saying, you know, Charles Chase saying, you can make any rules you want. Yeah. Because people are always going to want to come
always
here.
Always come here. That's exactly right.
And so why would you want to make it easier?
Exactly.
But at the same time, I think one of the things that needs to occur is to really emphasize the value of the African-American community and what the African-American community has really meant in terms of the historically what has shaped Charleston. And and it hasn't been... for instance, this radio station has an awful lot of jazz.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think that's great because it really does kind of hearken to a real contribution that's been made in the African American community, and I think they're beginning to sort of expose some of those same contributions in the food realm. And I think it might be time to start thinking about it in terms of architecturally. I mean, some of the history that I've read about the East Side, for instance. I mean, there were African American free blacks who were very much involved in how the East Side developed.
There was a rich tradition, and when you look at the city in that regard, you cited a number of things like the hospitality and the restaurant business, and you look at this, and I go in the restaurants, I eat out quite a bit. I never see a black server.
Oh, it's very rare.
See a black chef. I hardly ever see a black owner. And there's a reason for that. And it splits both ways. You know, the African American community hasn't necessarily stepped up entrepreneurially, but there really hasn't been the apparatus, financial and political support to really create that. So we've got to go beyond looking back at the contributions that African Americans have made. I'm more interested in the contributions African Americans can make.
Right.
So let's shift the conversation from reflection to a more aggressive, proactive proposition. And again, that's community-wide.
Right.
You know, I'm beyond saying, well, this person's the blame. Let's not talk about blame. Let's talk about how we can make a better city.
Right.
And a better city is a rich mix of different interests, different cultures, different personalities.
Well, if we homogenize, then the appeal really goes away.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
It happens
everywhere.
Absolutely true. So the other project that I want us to discuss is in fact this collaboration that come to light between the Medical University Roper Hospital and the VA to create a medical district with the green space that's dedicated to healing. And I happen to be at the city council meeting, mm-hmm. Joe Riley's last city council right. meeting, when the concept was presented in a short video, and I was incredibly intrigued.
Right.
This is another case of your being in the right place at the right time, or whatever you want to call it, and certainly seems to be a wonderful opportunity here. It seems rather loose at this point, obviously, but it does seem prescient in many ways. Right. I was just reading about a Harvard-educated physician, Dr. Bill Thomas, who was directing a nursing home in upstate New York, and in 1991 said, okay, I'm going to break all the rules. And he brought in, he just wanted to end the idea that growing old was bad, and that a nursing home didn't have to be depressing, dull, or dispirited. And he had a staff, and he said, okay, I want to bring in dogs and cats and parakeets and rabbits and hens and hundreds of plants. And they had a vegetable garden and daycare for the staff, because they determined that children being present was another sort of healing opportunity. And the transformation was apparently a revelation.
I bet.
The prescription drug use fell. Many of the patients started dressing themselves and eating again. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Thomas has called it the Eden Project. And the determination was that this home was going to be less like a hospital and more like a garden.
Yeah.
And this certainly seems to be an echo of
what I
hear happening with this collaboration. So I know that these hospitals, I mean, one of the big hurdles obviously was getting them to connect in the first place. And so in a conversation, and I think the next sort of natural thing would be, how does the community actually become part of this? You touched on it briefly in terms of paths that sort of get people from point A to point B. You want to just talk to us a little bit about how, beyond the hospital community, how does the larger community sort of benefit from something like this?
Well, yeah, of course. The way it's envisioned is that it's hopefully to be an iconic green space that is the sort of armature for the medical district. But it doesn't belong to the medical district. It belongs to the larger community. And that can occur by connection. And I certainly can envision that people who live nearby will come to this asset and want to be in this place and move about this place, not because they're sick or they're visiting someone who's sick or they're employed. They simply want to come to a beautiful urban environment, green environment. So that's part of it. The other part of that is, one of the things that we've been looking at closely is, how do you cross the crosstown?
Oh, God.
How do you get from the Citadel to the medical district? Well, it's a challenge.
You wade.
It's a challenge. And so there's a study being made to see if we can actually have a on-grade crossing right at a key point which will connect these two. And I'm encouraged by the engineering studies that have been done that that's going to be possible. I know that the previous administration supported this idea. It's hopeful that the new administration, I think Mayor Tecklenburg is, I'm excited about his being in place. I think he's going to be supportive of a lot of these kinds of ambitions. The other thing that we did in that is we kind of, ironically, and I say this with a little tongue in cheek, discovered Long Lake. And Long Lake, the Alberta Long Lake, is a lake that everybody knows about, everybody drives by, and nobody pays any attention to. It's just sort of there. And this is an extraordinary asset that is being fundamentally underutilized and underappreciated. So the idea would be that if you could connect, say, the Citadel, Wagner Terrace, and North down, cross perhaps Haygood, then you're touching into the medical district, move down Courtney Street, which we hope to calm somewhat. Then you'll have the spline that runs east-west that connects the VA and the clinical row that Medical University is developing over there with the old horseshoe and Ashley Avenue in the original campus. Those things are tied together. And then linking Roper St. Francis. Then you cross Calhoun, and there will be some development along that edge at some time in the future, not in the near future, but at some point, tie in the Long Lake. And move along Lockwood, go into the beautifully renovated Colonial Lake, and then continue through the city. So you have this network, which will also tie into the low country low line in some fashion, makes it accessible, makes it so that someone can move. Then I'm assuming that I believe the bike lane at Ashley River is going through. I've not kept up with it lately. Well, that ties right into B Street. So there's right. another linkage to that. And the kind of space that we're imagining will be such that it was such an extraordinary public space, this sort of two-block-long connection that goes really essentially from Ashley Avenue all the way to the Ashley River Towers, and also to some degree, and perhaps in the future, to the VA, will allow traffic from Courtney to continue as it does now, will allow traffic from Jonathan Lucas over to President Street to continue exactly as it is now, essentially reduces Dowdy to a pedestrian focus. There'll be service paths and fire trucks and all those kinds of things, obviously, will be able to get through. And a key part of that is the Roper St. Francis and how that links to it. And it's been a very interesting process. We've had a series of four charrettes that we've involved the community. Now I think it's important to kind of tell this story to the community in a much broader way. And I think we'll get tremendous support because it's really a plus. And this is one of the first times that these institutions have, you know, made a formal commitment to work together in unison to make a much more healthy, as it were, medical environment.
I think it sounds quite promising. Yeah. I would think that you mentioned resiliency earlier right. on. I would think that there's a facet of this because this part of the peninsula sure. is plagued by all kinds of issues that relate to that. Yeah. And
it was created out of practically out of marsh.
Right. And landfill.
And landfill.
So I do think that it'll be interesting to see how that piece yeah. Fits into here. And so is it, you know, there are always going to be skeptics on these kind of projects. And obviously, I think you said your messaging was, you know, we're beginning to kind of hone your messaging mm-hmm. on how to really sort of reach out mm-hmm. into the community on this. And I know that sometimes the voices seem to be getting louder on these things, that
true.
These ambitions seem to be counter to something, to some perception, right. I suppose. But I think that health facet of it, public health facet of it, is so
makes
key.
Sense. And
in fact, after that city council meeting, I was talking to someone else who was there, and her comment was, well, you know, there seemed to be some grumbling among some of the African-American mm-hmm. People who were in mm-hmm. the audience at that city council meeting. And I suppose, is it just that there's suspicion from that community?
Sure. Justifiably. There's a history in this city and many others where the disenfranchised really aren't brought to the table. And certainly that exists in Charleston. And part of the issue that I think is so important is that we admit these things. We own them. Let's just own it.
Right.
And then figure out a way, how do we move forward? There was a question by one of the council members about West Edge
mm-hmm.
and the impact that might have on that, on the Gadsden Green in West Side area. And that's a legitimate question. So it's not something we should simply shy away from. We should look at this and say, well, then how do we contend with the implications of a development like that on a community? The same question we're asking about the Low Country Low Line.
You know, all how of do this you be- is about healing, right?
Yeah, it's all about how do you bring all of this, all these conversations together to realize something that was good. We lived at Shepherd Street near, I forget that cross street, when the cross town.
This is another place you lived.
Yeah, this is a child where the cross town came in, and we had to move because the cross town. There was no engagement. There was no consideration.
Right.
They realized that it's like water will always seek the easiest path, and the politics said, well, it's an African-American community. By the way, we can also get rid of the home of the president of the NAACP at the time. Let's just run it through here.
Oh,
and now we're stuck with this incredible scar
right.
in our city.
Absolutely.
We don't want scars anymore. And I think that what we're hearing from some in the community, and I don't know how pervasive it is, like, just let's bring people to the table so that everyone feels they have an investment in these enterprises. And I think that's not an unwarranted and unreasonable proposition. And we did that, for example, in the early charrettes that we had with the medical district.
Well, and I know, you know, the where is it, Courtney Street comes in, and the Long Lake is right beyond. There's what was originally the Charity Hospital,
yeah,
I guess, building.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and it's certainly been, I'm sure, it probably holds one of those positions that's not unlike Burke. You know, it's sort of like this is an emblem of our history. And how do you actually, what is it on offer, I guess, yeah, is really part of the question. You know?
Well, it used to be, I'm not really familiar with the Charity Hospital, but there was McClellan Banks, which mm-hmm. was the black hospital
right
back in a day before desegregation. And it was directed by Thomas McFall. Dr. Thomas McFall, and it was an important institution because first it was a small, very, very dilapidated facility on Cannon Street, and then this was built. This was seen as a bellwether in many ways because it meant that African Americans had access to reasonable health care in a public setting. That's gone. I forget which of the developments have taken that. There's no residue of that, actually,
right
there on the campus. But again, I think you can look back and understand that history. But I would make the case that how do we move that proposition further? How do we say, well, that's happening. There's really nothing we can do about what's happened. Let's do something about what we can achieve. And so the engagement of people at Gadsden Green and these other communities is really of critical importance. Isn't it one of the most extraordinary public schools? It's a charter school, I guess, in the city. It caters primarily to African American kids. It's right there in Gadsden Green.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you look at that and you see there are things that are happening. And I have a certain confidence and excitement that John Tecklenburg will see these. He sort of comes at it differently. I think Joe did a terrific job over his 40-year tenure. And I'm excited about Tecklenburg's. I think he's making a legitimate pledge to make a much more inclusive proposition. And so I think we can look at these things and talk about these issues without feeling uncomfortable. Let's have those conversations, but let's move those conversations toward proactive enterprises that see real gains.
Well, I know there's this movement in some places called institutional anchors, where, mm-hmm. For instance, the University of Pennsylvania, which mm-hmm. is historically been located kind of in a right. in a marginalized neighborhood, and the University of Chicago similarly, and both of those institutions have been making concerted efforts right. to actually do things within the community, whether right. it's procuring products from right. entrepreneurs in right. those communities mm-hmm. or developing schools or community centers
sure.
and those certain kinds of ways to sort of actively
right.
engage in those communities. And I would certainly guess that that's going to be part of the mix here. And I would think of that as a looking forward
yeah.
Kind
right.
of proposition. Right. And so in a way, we've touched on something that I've really felt needed to be said, the sort of about your, as an African American, sort of having that perspective. We're certainly seeing a lot of conversations, and I think that this has been part of Tecklenburg's messaging has to do with social justice mm-hmm. and inequalities.
Right. That's right.
There's still skepticism, and I think it's just a function of government. The way the homelessness.
Sure.
The homelessness intensity
yeah, yeah.
question has come up. But I do believe that right now it just feels like those conversations are happening
yeah.
and beginning to
right.
happen.
Right.
And I would hate to see those shut down by just a function of skepticism, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do think that both this Low Line and this medical district certainly have, as you've mentioned, sort of the ways to re-knit or
yeah.
to sort of be part of the of that re-knitting
yeah.
Of the, mm-hmm. the community.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be totally remiss, though, if I did not pose my oft-asked question.
Okay.
If you were mayor, what would you do? Now, one I didn't send to you to sort of think about.
Blindsided. I don't know. I think what I would do is, in part, what I have been saying all along. I think it has to be a process of inclusion. It has to be, we have to, I'd like to shift the conversation from what we shouldn't do and what we can't do to what we should do and what we can do. There's been a very, very vocal a voice in the city that has been resistant, and I understand that. And I'm beginning to see another voice that's out of echoing, but coming in and saying, but we can do and we should do. Somehow those have to meet. And the challenge, I think, for all of us is that how do we create opportunities to do that? And I think we have to do it both at a sort of grassroots level, and I think we have to do it at a sort of intermediate level of between neighborhood to neighborhood, and I think you have to do it at a governmental level in terms of the political level. But there has to be a shared vision for what the city can be. Charleston is never going to be the sleepy, beautiful little sleepy town that it used to be, nor should it be. It could still be a beautiful city, but it ought to be a city of vibrancy and engagement and energy. And so I think one has to sort of grease the skids to make that happen. And I think it has to sort of tap into groups that perhaps haven't felt they've had a voice, and to tap in those who've had a very vocal voice in these conversations, bring them together, and hopefully they can share some middle ground in terms of these conversations. So if I were mayor, that's what I would try to do. I have no idea how to do it.
And by middle ground, I'm sure you don't mean anything mediocre, if I know you, Ray. So I just want to thank you so much, Ray, for joining us in this conversation. The urban possibilities seem to hold so much possibility for the type of engagement within the community that could make these two possibilities or projects propel the city into a civic era that's very positive and thinking about the future, as well as sort of realizing what the past has given us, I suppose. So I just want to thank you very much for being here. I'm Whitney Powers, and that wraps up our latest segment of If You Were Mayor as part of the Small Talks Big Ideas series on OHM Radio. And again, we invite you to go online to the Small Talks Big Ideas Facebook page, and you can submit your questions, feedback, and ideas for this segment. We've posted digital files from our earlier episodes at ifyouweremayor.com/projects. So you just look for the Small Talks Big Ideas logo there. Next time, tune in to Small Talks Big Ideas for your chance to hear from the Lowcountry Local First. And thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM OHM Radio Charleston and supporting your local, nonprofit, commercial-free radio station.
Though some may reach for the stars, others will end behind bars. What the future has in store, no one ever knows before. No time may help you forget all that has happened before. It's too late to regret what is gone. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. When my luck is returning, all these years I've been learning to
save fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving, to make life worth the living. For it's my life I'm living, and my only concern. For tomorrow is my turn. When summer is gone, there's another to come. You can't stop years drifting by, even if you want to try. Though time may help you forget all that has happened, sweetheart, it's too late to regret. What is gone will be no more. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. My luck is returning. All these years I've been learning to save fingers from burning. Except tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn to receive without giving, to make life worth my living. For it's my life I'm living. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. For my love to be returning. All these years I've been learning from burning. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubt.